it's Diane. On my mind.
One of our studies looked at the candidates running for Congress for statewide offices and found a significant majority, you know, well over 300, who had either expressed doubts about the 2020 election or outright denied it.
Nick Corzanidi is a political correspondent for The New York Times. In the run-up to November's vote, his reporting is focused on right-wing efforts to shake belief in the country's free and fair election system and the threats those efforts pose to our democracy. He has examined public opinion, tracked candidate statements, and followed campaigns across the country to see just how widespread the lies about the 2020 results have become and the consequences for our system of government. Nick, you and your colleagues at the New York Times have been trying to figure out just how widespread the questioning of election results is among the GOP. What did you find?
Well, we did a poll trying to assess, I think, how the entire electorate, all voters, feel about the threats to our democracy and the state of that democracy. And as we were doing that polling, we saw some pretty strong residual, feelings left over from the 2020 election that get at a almost immediate or instinctual doubting of election results among both the Republican base and surprisingly even some independent voters. Overall, 26% of voters that we surveyed said that they weren't ready or would not have faith in the results of the 2022 midterm elections. Now, we're recording this, you know, about 3 weeks out from Election Day, so no votes have been tallied. There's no reports of fraud, even false reports of fraud yet. Yet already, you know, 26% and 41% of Republican voters said that they had little to no faith that the 2022 midterm elections would be tallied accurately. And so I think that shows just how foundational this doubting of the American election process has become to, you know, a decent size of the Republican base.
Now, just how widespread is it among the candidates themselves?
Well, there's a large number of candidates running for office this year who, you know, have explicitly cast doubts about the 2020 election. There was, you know, the 147 members of Congress who voted to overturn it on January 6th. One of our studies found more than 340 state legislative incumbents in battleground states had taken direct action to either undermine the faith in the results of the 2020 election or actually try and overturn them. And more broadly, a large number of New York Times reporters, including Karen Durish, Daniel Ivory, Jonathan Wiseman, and I, looked at the candidates running for Congress for statewide offices and found a significant majority, you know, well over 300, who had either expressed doubts about the 2020 election or outright denied it. So it is pretty foundational, I think, to some of these candidates running for office in the 2022 midterms.
After these January 6th hearings, one would have thought that evidence had been presented that would have somehow shaken the foundation of their beliefs that the 2020 election was rigged. Since there has been absolutely no proof whatsoever that that has happened, yet candidates continue to say this, and I gather to believe it. How do you account for that?
Well, I think there's just been, again, getting back to those kind of numbers we said earlier about doubts about the 2022 midterms, it's just become so foundational. And also, when you look at, you know, the Republican Party right now, the kind of de facto leader still remains former President Trump. There's obviously some rising stars, such as Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. There's, you know, kind of well-known Republicans who are trying to take a different tack, like former Vice President Mike Pence or Governor Chris Christie, away from, you know, looking at the 2020 election. But because former President Trump is just still so focused on that, it becomes a part of, you know, the mainstream, because anyone hoping for his support, which can very much help Republicans win, especially in a primary, then they have to kind of meet his litmus test about the 2020 election. So I think regardless of evidence, and while the January 6th committee made a very, you know, long and evidence-based case about the security of the 2020 election, then everything that went into the efforts to overturn it, that was kind of, we knew. I did a story in late November that I talked to every Secretary of State or election top election official in the country, and they found a widespread fraud. So, you know, we knew this pretty quickly. So I think it's something that is foundational and has never really been based in any kind of evidence. So any new evidence, I don't think is going to move voters. And, you know, we're seeing that in the way the 2022 midterms are shaping up as well.
Is this, do you think, happening across the country, or are we talking about certain parts of the country?
I think it is. It's certainly a national trend. Obviously, it might be stronger in, say, a deeply red state where the primary is really the general election, right? You know, we see this in a lot of polarized states. It's true in, say, New York City, where the mayoral election is not the general election, it's really the primary, because whoever the Democrat is that wins, they will probably become the mayor. In a lot of the deeply red states, you know, the primary is basically the general election for, say, governor or secretary of state. So the influence of someone like a former President Trump can really swing those primaries and therefore kind of decide the general election. And I think that's where you might see candidates stake out a more aggressive or hardline position, kind of casting doubts on the 2020 election. Now, that said, in certain battleground states, especially for Secretary of State this cycle, we've seen very, very staunch deniers of the 2020 election running to be the top election official in Arizona, in Nevada, and in Michigan, three critical states for the presidential election and also for control of Congress, just as those are some of the swingiest states in the country. And through the primary process, and Michigan has its own kind of unique nominating process, but still those, you know, candidates who their main policy position is doubts about our electoral process and doubts about the 2020 election, were able to win on that. So I think it is really a kind of national through line that has, you know, kind of taken hold within the party. At the same time, though, it's certainly not the number one issue driving Republican voters right now.
And that seems to be the economy.
Yeah. The economy, inflation, prices is really become the top issue in this election in the last 3 weeks here. And that's across the board. You know, we set out to do our poll to kind of understand how voters felt about democracy. And 71%, you know, wide majority said, yeah, our democracy is at risk, but only 7% said it was their top issue. And so when you have something as dramatic as the country's very foundations being at risk, for that to not be a top issue just shows, I think, how visceral a lot of people are feeling about economic issues. It's Democrats, Republicans, and independents all list the economy and inflation as their top issue. And it's just something that, you know, you deal with on a day-to-day basis. So every day when you wake up worried, I can't afford the normal groceries I would buy this week, or gas is going to, you know, kind of make it so I can't take my one night out to dinner or my kids out to dinner. That's so much more immediate for a voter, especially as they head into an election, than something as seemingly far away as the erosion of our democratic institutions.
And they are blaming Democrats for the economic conditions today, despite everything that President Biden has done.
Yeah, I mean, this is the game. This is the politics of the economy. When you're president, you own it for better or worse, despite, you know, kind of what little control any president or Republican or Democrat really has over the economy. There's certainly policies they can do to impact it. There's changes that the Fed can make. The Treasury Secretary, you know, obviously would have some sway, but macroeconomic forces are sometimes out of the, control of the ruling party. Just look at the war in Ukraine is certainly putting a lot of pressure on a lot of our different supply chain and economic throughways.
Yeah.
You sense it. You see, if you're a Republican campaign manager right now, you see an opportunity in the floundering economy, and you're going to press the tack on that.
Sounds as though we're going back to James Carville's statement, is the economy stupid? But going back to some of the beliefs that the 2020 election was rigged, give me an example of some of the theories about a stolen election and who might have been behind it and how they operated, in the belief of some of those who think it was stolen.
Sure. So I think there's two main buckets right now about conspiracies regarding the 2020 election. And the first is focused on absentee ballots and mail ballots. There has long been, and President Trump was doing this in 2016, saying that absentee and mail voting is insecure. He would make all sorts of unfounded claims that people could stuff ballot boxes. There was no, chain of custody, when, of course, that was all false. Mail voting is actually one of the most secure ways to vote because there's a paper trail for every vote. But regardless of that fact, there's long been these doubts about mail voting that started with President Trump, and he really seized on them in 2020. There became this theory that, operatives with allegiances to the Democrats were going around cities and collecting a bunch of ballots from voters and either filling them out or stuffing ballot boxes, things like that, and that they were able to then, tip the scales of the election by stuffing ballot boxes. And there's a documentary that purports to show this. Now, it's been widely debunked by bipartisan election officials, even Republicans, that, almost every finding in this documentary is false. But it's called 2,000 Mules. And in our polling, we found that 26% of the electorate, so more than one in four, had heard about this documentary. And that's a pretty significant penetration for a conservative documentary that, has basically been found to be completely baseless and, been, again, debunked by both Republican and Democratic election officials. So that obsession with mail voting and these conspiracy theories about stuffed ballots and stuffed ballot boxes, and then some of the more outlandish ones that somehow ballots were being printed overseas and sent in. Now, that's, again, impossible, completely false. But I think if you see the distrust sowed about mail voting, you see the conspiracies get more and more outlandish. Now, getting into outlandish, the other big conspiracy is about election machines and that they are somehow flipping votes. And a key accelerant of that was a lawyer for the Trump team known as Sidney Powell, who was casting a lot of doubts about the Dominion voting system. She gave that famous press conference where somehow Hugo Chavez, the former dictator who passed away years before the 2020 election, had some influence. And there's been a pretty dedicated and passionate wing of influencers, I should call them, I guess, election denial influencers, who remain obsessed with election machines. And that includes Mike Lindell, the CEO of MyPillow, Patrick Byrne, the former CEO of Overstock.com. These are wealthy guys, and they've been funding a lot of vigilante efforts to try and prove that these election machines are corrupt. And again, there's zero evidence of this. There's never been anything proven about it. But due to their, I think, both staunch belief. Now, I wouldn't even say that these people are necessarily, spreading. They're not lying because they believe this deeply. They believe that these voting machines are corrupt. So their persistence in that deep belief, as well as their resources, has kind of kept conspiracies about election machines alive.
You mentioned earlier secretaries of state. And the fact that Republicans are pushing for their election, specifically those who have been election deniers?
Yes. There is a broad swath of candidates, if we go back to before the primaries, who were running to be the top election official in their state, who explicitly denied the results of the 2020 election. And there's actually a organization of them. Jim Marchant, who is the Republican candidate for Secretary of State in Nevada, when he announced his candidacy, I forget if it was very early this year or perhaps even later in 2021, he worked to put together a network of what he called the America First slate of secretaries of state. And this network includes Mark Fincham, the Republican candidate in Arizona, Christina Caramo, the Republican candidate for Secretary of State in Michigan, Doug Mastriano, who's running for governor in Pennsylvania, but because the governor appoints the Secretary of State, he's included. It includes Audrey Trujillo, who's running in New Mexico, and a host of other candidates. I think there was 25. Tina Peters, the clerk in Colorado, who organized a breach of her own election systems and software. So there was this, you know, kind of cohort of deniers who were all working together to try and get each other elected. And they were somewhat successful in the primaries. And now those ones I mentioned in Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, Pennsylvania with State Senator Mastriano, they all are going to be on the ballot in November. And these are, you know, people who have taken anti-democratic stances to be running to be the top election official.
So, Nick, explain exactly what it is that the secretaries of state have responsibility for in terms of election results.
So it does vary state by state. Like, for example, the Wisconsin Secretary of State actually has no authority over elections. They created a bipartisan election commission. So it's not always, but in the vast majority of cases, the Secretary of State is the top election official for a state. And so they get to, you know, kind of decide at a very macro level how elections are run. They are normally in charge of resources. They can kind of set policies. They can make adjustments on the fly. And in some states, they are involved in the certification of results. So in Arizona, for example, the Secretary of State is one of the people who helps certify the election results. In Nevada, the Secretary of State just has to be present when the justices of the court certify the result. But, you know, we're in such uncharted territory. We don't know how, you know, requisite that presence would be in terms of still getting certification. But you could see a candidate, you know, who has held deeply anti-democratic views and doubts about the 2020 election to be in a position in the future where they have to certify a result they might not like, and they've shown in the past that they wouldn't do that. Some of these candidates have even said, I would not have certified the 2020 election. That could be something that could really create a lot of chaos in the next presidential election.
Well, when you say they could make adjustments on the fly, what does that really mean?
So that's, I meant more regarding like voting rules and access. So if we look at the 2020 election, which, you know, was held under unprecedented circumstances with the global pandemic and making sure everyone was able to vote, you know, and then we saw the postal system failing. Different secretaries of state, like in Pennsylvania, they said, okay, you know, we know that this is leading to a lot of delays, so we're going to accept ballots that were postmarked by a certain date. And then it went through the court system and the court approved it. In Wisconsin, the election commission realized that they have a signature requirement on their ballots. And in nursing homes and different places that had very strict COVID protocols, that would be difficult. So they did away with that. So there's like policies that can adjust to challenges in real time, perceived or real, that a secretary of state can kind of, you know, be one of the people making the calls about how to adjust.
Now a quick break. Hi, it's Diane. Join me for my next book club event, a conversation with Sheila Johnson. She's co-founder of BET, all about her memoir, Walk Through Fire. That's coming up Wednesday, April 24th at 6 p.m. Eastern. Find out more, register at dianeweem.org/book club. Here's the rest of my conversation with Nick Corzanetti, national political correspondent for the New York Times. You've talked about vigilante supporters seeking to ensure that votes go a certain way. How do they operate?
Well, we'll go back to my two bucket analogy. So there's one that has been basically since the 2020 election going door to door in various parts of the country and knocking on doors and asking if the voters listed on the voter rolls still live there. And, you know, if they fit all the different voter registration characteristics. And whenever they find an anomaly, they will try and flag it and challenge a voter's registration.
What kind of anomaly would cause people to report that voter?
Let's say the person didn't live there anymore, had moved. It was a, you know, summer home. They had, you know, two addresses or anything like that. Or, you know, the birthdays didn't line up, or some of the family members still live there, others didn't. So they would then challenge that voter. And again, a lot of these issues are well known to election officials and aren't necessarily disqualifying. You can have two homes, you just can't vote from both of them. So that has led to a lot of these vigilante challenges. And some have, you know, really overwhelmed local election officials. You know, in Georgia, one county received well over 10,000. And due to a new voting law in Georgia, they need to hear every single one of those challenges individually. And you can just imagine how much time that would take, and especially given all the other tasks involved in upholding elections, that would just be a real burden that a lot of election officials are feeling the weight of. The other is, you know, those partisan poll watchers I was talking about earlier. And there's a large coordinated effort among these outside Republican groups, mostly, not the party as much, to recruit and train these partisan poll watchers to really be on the lookout for voter fraud. And I think it's important to say, as much as we can say it, and I said it earlier, but I'll just repeat it, voter fraud in America is exceedingly rare. Yes, isolated cases happen, you know, well into just the double digits, nowhere near what would ever be required to swing a presidential election.
So what can these people actually do at the polls?
So again, it varies state by state, but I think what a lot of them are hoping to do is, quote unquote, collect evidence of, you know, either poor behavior, not sticking to the rules, election officials making a mistake, and then sending that in to potentially challenge, you know, the results from a certain area, or, you know, bring a case against the way a state carried out its election. So that would be one. And then the second is, and this again varies explicitly by state, but to try and challenge, you know, kind of an individual vote as it's going, either through a process or if they say they don't recognize this voter. Now, there's so many federal laws that protect voters from those kind of, you know, accusations, intimidation tactics, and a lot of states would immediately throw a partisan poll watcher out for doing this. The Secretary of State of Georgia just had to make an explicit statement that challenges are not allowed at the polls in person because there had been threats of that, right? So I think it's more disturbance and, you know, kind of intimidation that I think that could be the real result of some of these poll watchers rather than an actual disenfranchising a voter.
Keeping people from going to the polls out of a certain fear of being hassled or somehow interfered with. What are Democrats doing in the meantime?
So Democrats have really stood up a big voter protection program. They have, I think, 125 staff across the country, but obviously targeted in certain states where this is known to be a problem to try and protect that. Against that. There's also a lot of outside groups that are training lawyers and volunteers trying to, you know, be prepared to help voters should they be challenged or should any issue arise. And then there's also, you know, and this has been true of elections for as far as I've been covering them, that there's, you know, these hotlines that voters can call that either go to election officials, that go to party officials, that go to outside groups with lawyers, they can help them navigate it. This is all, I think, something that's concerning election officials greatly, this threat of these partisan poll watchers. But when the story we did, and you know, when we looked at the issues in the primary, they were still isolated. You know, for the vast majority of the country, voting was not necessarily, you know, an intimidating experience or dealing with a lot of these partisan poll watchers. And a lot of local election officials are confident that, yes, they're concerned, but they're also prepared. They're more prepared than they've been in the past. And that this won't be, you know, anything that they expect many voters will have to deal with.
Do we know who is behind these vigilante groups?
I don't think there's a grand puppet master. A lot of these groups have kind of, you know, come up from the grassroots and are finding like-minded people within their own state and starting statewide groups. Now, there are some national organizations that are running poll watcher trainings that, you know, certainly encourage voters to be on the lookout for fraud, even though it doesn't really exist in a widespread manner. So Cleta Mitchell, who's the election lawyer for Trump, who was on the call when he rang up Secretary of State Raffensperger, she's been leading trainings in multiple states, you know, has even dubbed it, I think, her election detective agency, and has been encouraging, you know, poll watchers to be on the lookout for any kind of evidence of fraud or you know, misbehavior on election officials' part. So there are some national groups. There's also, you know, candidates who are starting to embrace it. Ron Johnson, the senator from Wisconsin, just put out a video yesterday instructing voters how to challenge a ballot or a situation or anything they see in the polls. So you're starting to see candidates embrace this too. And, you know, that would be something confined to Wisconsin, but still a pretty powerful, you know, national leader there in Senator Johnson. So it's certainly, you know, loose networks. There are some macro figures like a Cleta Mitchell or Steve Bannon who are trying to bring some organization to this, but at the same time, it's very decentralized as well.
The election turnout in Georgia apparently has been overwhelmingly large for that state. I wonder whether that is because so many people feel that some people are trying to take that vote away from them, or because of the issues that we're facing, as you mentioned earlier, the economy. So it's hard to know whether they're coming out because they believe in democracy or they're coming out because they're angry about the economy.
Yeah, I mean, again, if you just look at the polling numbers that we've seen, the economy is really driving voters right now. We're just at a different moment, I think, in terms of our civic engagement. You know, I think the 2020 election, it set so many records and it changed so much voter behavior that voting became a part of people's lives in a way it hadn't before. And, you know, if you're just looking at the early turnout projections that are being done by both Republicans and Democrats right now, it's showing yet another record-breaking year. So I think, you know, the Georgia turnout is kind of indicative of, hopefully, you know, just a more engaged American electorate, which we could certainly use. We've always lagged other Democratic countries in our turnout. That's probably it. There is, obviously, for some voters, when new restrictions are put in voting, it's a big motivator. And, you know, I think we even saw that in the 2020 primaries in Wisconsin when Republicans in the state legislature refused to push back the day of the primary, and they held it amid, you know, one of the peaks of the early COVID pandemic. And we saw voters in Milwaukee, you know, they normally had 180 precincts. It was down to 4 just because they couldn't find enough poll workers. They turned out. And, you know, it helped tip what was a 50-50 state Supreme Court race to a Democratic landslide by 9 points. So I think when you go at, especially ballot access and voting rights, so less, I think, some of these challenges to democracy and trying to subvert election results and more the making voting harder, that can have the adverse effect of both impacting, I mean, and motivating the voters whose lives you're trying to make harder. And then also it can lead to, you know, a surge in organizing and get out the vote efforts by groups who are like, okay, we know we have to work doubly as hard to overcome this. And that ends up also leading to surges in voting. So I think there's a whole confluence that's showing a surge in turnout right now.
You mentioned earlier that states are taking measures to safeguard what happens at the polls. What kinds of measures can they realistically take? You've said that there, in some states, they've said there will be no intimidation of voters at the polls, but how does that word get out?
I think, again, it goes back to that findings that a lot of the issues that we saw in the primaries were isolated. They're concerning. They, you know, affected some voters, absolutely, who experienced it, but it wasn't widespread. And so I think when you look at that, I think voters can have confidence that, okay, I know that there's issues out there. I can be prepared for them. I can vote by mail and there won't be any issues. And, you know, kind of just gird yourself for it. And states are doing the best they can to protect them, especially protect the poll workers who, you know, have been subjected to endless harassment. So there's been laws passed. Colorado just passed a law making it a felony to harass or intimidate a poll worker. And I think Florida is considering that. The Nevada candidate for Secretary of State is pushing for it. So I think that will, you know, probably we'll see a lot more of those laws next year. That seems to be a lot of bipartisan agreement on that. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's a hotly contested race. And I think local election officials are doing everything they can to make sure that voting is easy and, you know, falls within the rules and that all the protections that federal and state laws afford a voter are enforced.
I wonder about the poll workers themselves. To what extent have we seen a drop-off in volunteers working at the polls because they fear this kind of perhaps confrontation when they're simply going there to certify a vote as it comes in?
That was a big concern of secretaries of state and, you know, statewide election officials. Following the 2020 election, you know, so many poll workers were harassed. And, you know, we even saw in the January 6th committee, those two poll workers from Georgia who became, you know, targets of a national right-wing conspiracy theory. And their lives were upended. There has been, I think, some reinforcements that have come in terms of younger voters being willing to work the polls, and other incentives. I know, like, at least in 2020, Philadelphia kept jacking up how much people were getting paid. They're very lowly paid. You know, it's $200 a day or something, but maybe if they made it four, more people would do it. We haven't, I think, quite fully grasped whether there's going to be any issues in terms of staffing. I try and talk to as many election officials as I can to see if that's going to be an issue in terms of how many precincts can be open. But as of now, I haven't heard any, you know, five alarm fires, which is good. But I think, I guess one concern looking beyond 2022 is if there is a lot of harassment and challenges and, you know, more of what we saw in an isolated way in the primaries, then we might see a greater atrophy of poll workers before the 2024 election. And how do you address that? So I think it's a concern, but at least so far as I've heard, we haven't seen any kind of drastic drop-off in terms of poll workers being willing to work on Election Day.
Last question for you. What's your best and worst scenarios here as far as the 2022 elections go?
Well, I don't like to be too predictive. I'd say, I guess, the best-case scenario is just the election goes off without a hitch. We have record turnout. More Americans vote in a midterm than ever, and we have no long challenges, no legal cases stretching out or undermining faith in the vote, and everything certified. I guess anything under that is less than ideal. You know, there are some candidates who have already started to cast doubts on the results, and they're not going to accept or they're not committing to accepting the results. And I think that's, you know,
if they lose, they'll never
say that, but sure. I mean, it's kind of implied.
Yeah.
And I think if we have more of those, especially in a close race or, you know, a highly visible, you know, race, what kind of further damage that would do to the faith in the electoral process. But I don't want to get too far into doomsday scenarios because we just hope we never have to see them.
We can only hope for the best. Nick Korasanidi, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Nick Korasanidi, domestic correspondent covering national politics for the New York Times. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, brpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. I thank you for listening. See you next week. I'm Diane Rehm.